This is a HeadGum Original.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
We talked on last Wednesday, so it's been a week.
Oh, okay. A lot's changed in a week.
What's changed?
Well, I don't know. I just remember last time saying the only thing you can count on is that everything's changing every day.
Well, that's the same. Why would your example of how a lot's changed be the one thing that hasn't?
You're right.
At the end of the last episode, I recorded a little addendum saying that we would be taking a break from new episodes of Dead Eyes. And the reason for this was that I had gotten some work touring with Guster. 5 weeks, 21 shows in 19 cities. And I made a little joke about how maybe I would get fired from the gig if things didn't go well, and that if that happened, maybe I would come back and talk about it on the podcast. Well, here we are. And it's not that I got fired exactly. It's that the whole job got canceled. Just like everything else these days.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
I'm Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. I was told the reason was that he saw my audition tape and he thought that I had dead eyes. And that's the short version. I'm talking to my friend Ryan Miller from the band Guster.
I want to write more songs. Oh, I had that other idea too.
A few weeks before this conversation, he and I were on stage together, night after night, performing in front of big crowds. He had invited me to go on tour with the band and do weird improvised comedy things during their concerts.
What life lessons or advice do you have for us? Sun is 5 months old. This is written like a telegram. Sun is 5 months old. Stop.
I walked on stage in San Diego to an audience that I would say maybe two people in the audience that I knew personally. They might have been the only people in the entire audience who had any idea who I was.
Right.
I think that's a realistic assessment of that crowd.
Okay.
And by the end of the show, the audience had taken to chanting my name on three separate occasions, not prompted by me. The show ended, and I walked through the crowd with the audience chanting my name. Tour made it all the way to St. Louis, Missouri, the state I grew up in, not too far from where my dad was born. And my parents were in the audience for what ended up being the final show of the tour. I got to do that thing where I mentioned them from the stage. It's not something that I've ever had the opportunity to do before in plays or improv shows. Felt really nice.
This is a special night. I don't know if anyone here, very few people know this, but I'm from Missouri. Yeah. My dad grew up in St. Charles. My parents are here tonight, and we're from. And I grew up in Jefferson City. So this is a real special night. And so
the first night in L.A., I asked what's something that people are worried about, and one person said coronavirus, and we did a song about it, where it was about washing your hands. Lake Tahoe. It was a few nights later. I asked what's something people are worried about, and everybody, including a child in the audience, they all said, it was almost like the whole audience was just shouting, coronavirus, coronavirus. And that was when I realized, oh, that's what everyone is worried about now. And on the last night of the tour in St. Louis, you said, I'm not going to say anything about it. And then at the end, you did say something about it. And you said,
and what we've hoped to do do in the last couple weeks as things get really weird out there is to just be here and positive and give ourselves a moment to...
And then I immediately jumped in and said...
Not positive for the virus. Just to have a positive attitude.
We're a good team. We're a good team.
I never check my phone during shows usually, but on this particular evening, I needed to verify a piece of trivia about the venue we were performing at that I wanted to mention to the audience. And I saw that my phone had blown up. I had way more messages and notifications than was normal for a Wednesday evening. And I knew that wasn't a good sign. I mean, nothing great happens at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night that people feel the need to send you messages about. A couple of the musicians who were backstage said, "Don't check your phone. It's all bad news." But I did it, and I saw the headline.
Tom Hanks and his wife, the actress Rita Wilson, have announced that they have both tested positive for coronavirus.
Tom Hanks announcing overnight that he and wife Rita Wilson are both infected. They're currently in Australia.
Now, we do have some breaking news moments ago. Actor Tom Hanks, his wife Rita Wilson, they have tested positive for coronavirus. By the way, they're in our prayers tonight.
I kind of took my breath away. It was genuinely shocking. And then I saw all the jokes that people were tagging me in or sending me. They were all things like, "Who has dead eyes now?" or "You gave Tom Hanks the coronavirus." I felt really bad. The gut punch of the news itself and that people were joking about it as if this was an outcome I would be pleased with. And I know I'm being oversensitive about this because I don't think anyone who was making jokes had bad intentions. All of it just took me by surprise in a really bad way.
It was basically like, oh, that joke isn't funny anymore. Even though it's not really what it's about. This isn't about this podcast obviously isn't about Tom Hanks. But you take the lumber out of the bottom floors and the whole thing can tumble. So I was just like, I was super bummed for you because obviously I felt that. Like I felt like this isn't going to be fun anymore. Although I will say this other part, and I'm sure that this is probably true, is like I know you as a quick mind and as an improviser, and there was part of me that was like, you're going to figure out a way to talk about this. You know, you'll find a way to yes and your way out of this. That was my second thought after I was sad for you. I was like, this is an obstacle, and this is what you thrive on. That was my thought.
I went back out on stage. The show must go on, right? You know, I had another few minutes to perform and I just had to suck it up and act like things were fine.
And then I started thinking about what a special place this is and about this building in particular. And I thought about the thing that it says on the Wikipedia page I looked up. About all the people who've performed or spoken in this very room. Did you know that Albert Einstein once spoke in this room? That's right. And Dwight D. Eisenhower.
And then the next morning, I was having breakfast with my folks when Ryan called, and it went straight to voicemail.
Shai Connor, got some news. We did it. It's a success. I say this in the past tense.
The audio cuts out a little, so just to be clear, what he says is, Shai Connor, that's a nickname he gave me during one of the shows, we did it. The tour was a success. I say this in the past tense because it's over.
So call me when you get this or any of us, but I think we're all going home today. All right. Good job. Bye.
Everybody in the band, all the musicians, we'd been living together in a tour bus for 3 weeks. They all booked their flights immediately and went back home.
On some level, it's a bummer that we didn't get to finish. But it was also the reality was starting to creep into about how irresponsible it was feeling to be on tour. And so it's kind of, you know, there's this hierarchy of, well, you know, it's hard to mourn the tour when the world is sort of self-destructing in so many ways. Everything became very hierarchical on tour where I was like, okay, the world is sort of falling apart right now. It doesn't feel right to stand up there and make jokes.
By the time I was on the phone trying to switch my flight to get back to New York City, there was a 2-hour wait to talk to anyone at American Airlines. I figured it would be just as easy to take a 2-hour bus ride back to my hometown to stay with my parents in Jefferson City, Missouri.
You're much happier being in Missouri than you are in New York, right?
I would like to be back in New York, but it just doesn't seem like it makes any sense for me to go back there. It feels like when New York is the epicenter of the pandemic, the last thing that anybody needs is like, well, here comes Connor. Maybe this will help. You know, like it feels like I could only make things worse. It's just one more person being a drain on whatever resources are there.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, my parents can use my help here. It's not even necessarily anything to do with happiness. It's just a matter of like, I don't think it would be smart or useful for me to leave my current situation to go to a city that is, I think, on the verge of things getting worse, you know?
Yeah. It feels that way from here. Are you having any kind of like, oh, this is what's going to be my life every day for the near foreseeable future? And how does that make you feel?
I don't feel creative.
Right.
I've had various, you know, groups and individuals who are itching to like do something. And they'll be like, hey, let's do this. You know, we'll do like a virtual improv show, or, you know, we'll do a virtual open mic. I don't even have the energy really to respond to it because I just don't feel creative. I feel like that part of me is on pause. I don't feel the impulse to be funny. I don't feel, it just is like that setting is a little bit sort of turned off.
And have you been in this situation before?
Where my creativity turns off?
Yeah.
I've had moments where I've been feeling bad, and normally that's the thing that at some point sort of snaps me out of it. But in this case, it's, you know, I'm calm, I'm not panicking, but it's not like having like a numb arm or a numb leg or something like that, but it is like there's a part of me that's a little bit numb right now.
At a certain point, it's hard to like laugh about or be the quartet playing, you know, classical music as the Titanic goes down, even though we're doing a good job of it, where I was just like, this doesn't feel responsible.
Whenever I think about like comedy dying, I think if there was even just one person left and they were funny, I think comedy would still be alive, even with no audience. Because at first I was like, well, as long as there's one person, then one other person to laugh at it. But like, I don't even think you need the person to laugh at it, because I think the funny person would know how to be funny even in the absence of all other humans. You can tell a joke to a tree. Who cares if that tree thinks it's funny? I don't.
You got to look at what's positive. Maybe that's the big takeaway.
But there's so much to wallow in. When you're looking at a situation like that, it's like you go into a grocery store and there's like a lot of healthy food in there, but you're like, here's a whole section where there's a lot of broccoli and a lot of carrots and things that are good for you. And I'm like, yeah, I can't hear you. I'm in the soda aisle.
Sorry, I'm in a hot tub full of jalapeno flavored Cheetos.
I have pudding to eat and I know it's killing me, but this is what I'm drawn to.
Yeah, well, I hear you, bud. I guess my only advice would be, just as a point of practice, is to just force yourself into the "I'm healthy, this too shall pass," and when it does, things will be shaken up. But like, you're gonna still know how to act, and you'll still have a voice, and you'll still be an exceptional improviser. And we're gonna go back on the road and finish this, like in some versions. So I don't know. That's all.
Dead Eyes will be right back.
I had no idea you even knew what a piano was. Good job there, Connor.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm at my parents' house, a house we lived in from when I was in junior high, 7th and 8th grade. And it's weird. I normally love visiting here, but normally I have some idea of when I'm going to go home. And at the moment, I have no idea. Maybe I'll be here for another week, or maybe I'll be here for the next year and a half, because it's March 2020 and there is a virus that is spreading all over the world. And nobody knows anything for certain.
Okay, I'm going to record now.
What are you doing?
I am playing on Messenger a game.
What's the game?
I can't remember. You're disturbing me. I'm trying to answer.
My mom was born in a little town in Wicklow County, Ireland, Arklow. She met my dad in Germany during the Vietnam War. He enlisted because at the time the thinking was that you were better off enlisting than waiting to be drafted. He remembers being in a room and someone came out and said, "Does anyone here know how to type?" My dad was the only one who raised his hand. He got stationed in Frankfurt. Everyone else in that room got sent to Vietnam. I sometimes think about how unfair that seems, but also that I wouldn't exist if my dad hadn't learned how to type.
A draw is a loss to me. I need to win. So what are we doing? What are we talking about?
I suppose we could talk about what you remember about when I got fired from Band of Brothers.
Well, I have a memory of somebody saying that the lady who came and told you that you'd been fired said, if it's any consolation, apparently there were four people that went back in the room. The vote was 3-1 or something, which, of course, was suggesting that everybody else did want you in any case, but that Tom Hanks didn't want you.
The whole reason for the re-audition was that there were people arguing on my behalf, the people who had cast me.
Sure, yeah.
I'm confident that I was not told that there was a vote. And I don't think if there had been a vote that they would have told me.
No. Somebody said that. I thought it was you.
No, it may
just have been in conversation that somebody said, "I think this is what happened." Because we were all saying, "Oh, I think this is what happened. I think this."
Who's we were all? Just like you and Dad?
Just generally your support system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it may have been a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it feels weird to even be talking about it now, although it is a story about how you have a certain idea of how things will go.
Sure.
And one of the hard things about that is that you've already sort of like laid the tracks mentally in your mind. You have an idea of at least what the next few weeks are going to be like. And when that's not even something that you can count on, that's a hard thing for us to adjust to mentally.
And the fact that, bringing it back to your experience, we were all, and you also, obviously, we were all on such a high that you had got this little part. It was so exciting that this was happening for you. So that was a big disappointment for all of us at the time, you know, that you'd been so disappointed. This is people's real, like, livelihood, though, you know. This is beyond any...
Yeah, this is everybody.
We thought that was such a big deal at the time, and really... wasn't life and death.
No.
And the expression I always have with you guys is nobody's child died. You know, that's, I always think that's like the worst thing. So yeah, you survived it fine.
Have you ever gone through anything does this remind you of anything?
No.
This is all new.
I don't ever remember anything even remotely like this. I'm trying to just like tell myself, just do what you're doing, and eventually this too shall pass. The question is when. Could be a while.
You say that a lot. You say this too shall pass, and I've seen a lot more people saying it over the past week than I've ever...
Yes, they're copying me. Everything does pass. The worst times of your life do pass. For most people, it gets better. Not for everybody.
What's it like having me back home?
It's great. That's the little bonus, because you weren't planning. You don't get home often enough.
Part of me was a little bit disappointed that I wasn't going to get to visit the house. I wasn't going to get to visit you guys
at
home.
Yeah, you'd like to be home.
But now, you know, I don't know how long I'll be here.
This what? Is.
Is there any downside to me being here or for you guys? Is it helpful?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's made all the difference, because I think also it's given your dad a lift.
Well, you're here longer than we expected. We thought you'd be here a couple of days, and now it's going on the second week.
Yeah, well, actually, originally I was just going to see you in St. Louis and wasn't even going to have a chance to come visit the house.
Yeah, I know. We're glad to have you here, though.
My dad grew up in St. Louis, but for a time, my parents lived in Chicago after they were first married. My dad got a job selling insurance, but he was also trying to be an actor. He saw an audition for a group that was going to be doing improv, and he tried out for it. It was run by a man named Del Close, who, if you know anything about improv, is kind of a big deal in that world. You can see Del Close in a tiny role in George Lucas's second film, American Graffiti. But he's mostly known as one of the most important founding figures in the modern art of what's usually called long-form improvisation. And he cast my dad in one of the groups he set up to develop this art form during a year when Del Close was on the outs with Second City. The group was called the Chicago Extension, and when I hear my dad describe what they were doing, a lot of it sounds like an embryonic version of what I would end up doing decades later at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
Improv is basically the same rules that apply, but now it's more slick, I think. You guys have studied. You've gone through the process at UCB. They've got the 101 and 102, 201, 301 level. We just got on stage and they said, here are about three rules. You know, listen, yes, and keep moving and be funny. And those were the rules. And now now there's a lot more rules, and it's a lot more planned and structured, I think, and the people know what to do, and they don't go off on tangents the way we used to and have long periods of nobody laughing.
Del Close had left Second City. I remember you telling me about how people from Second City at the time would come over and watch shows that you guys were doing.
Yeah, we got after Del left to go back to Second City. He was there and gone a couple of times. He was fired and he was rehired and fired again. And then we started a show called Dream Theater, and people would stay in the audience and they would tell us their dreams, and then we'd improvise off those dreams. It's sort of like what you do off ASCAT now, taking some bits of what they said. But our stuff was weird and it wasn't always funny. And I remember one night seeing John Belushi and a bunch of people from Second City sit in the audience and not a smile, not a giggle, not a laugh. It just was deadly. You could hear the crickets in the room. And it was, we did a thing one night. Our improv group got hired by the Wrigley Company. We went up to the Wrigley building.
That's the chewing gum?
The chewing gum. And we had to, they turned it, put us in a room, sitting around a table. And they turned on the tape recorder and they said, just improvise about chewing gum. We got hired for the same thing once for F8, it was called. It was V8 was going to come out with a fruit drink called F8. And we had to improvise for about an hour or so. They paid us to go in. I think we each got $25 to improvise about F8.
Is that supposed to be like fate?
No, it was fruit juice.
Oh, I know, but like F8 looks like fate if it's...
Yeah. Well, any kind of ideas like that we could come up with. And none of those ever amounted to anything either. But the ad agency was so desperate, they hired us to come up with ideas that they could steal.
Did you have a feeling that you were good at it when you were doing it?
I thought I was okay. I would have liked to have done it longer. But I only did it about 6 months because then we get the chance to come back to the TV station in Jeff City, and I left it. And then I thought it was very helpful, and I always thought it helped me on the air and doing TV, doing the weather, because that was all improvised, and doing the kids show, which was all improvised. But I'd like to have done more with the group. I'm kind of like my dad, is that I like the security of a job and a paycheck and knowing that something's coming next week. So when I got a chance to go back to the TV station, that kind of was it for me. And it, because it wasn't that much money, but it was steady and it was, you know, then you came along and then your sister came along and I was comfortable with that and in a nice rut, I guess.
Right. And the instability of show business was not an appealing, it was not enough of a draw.
I think the amount of rejection you get would kill me. I don't know if I could take what actors go through in getting that constant rejection. Rejection is tough. Are you comfortable with hit and miss?
I mean, I've had to get comfortable with it because I don't have a choice. I mean, that was a big reason why I took such a long break from it, was because I needed to get to a place where it didn't matter as much in a way, which it's strange because now I kind of have slowly put myself into a position where, you know, I have to get a certain amount of work or I'll lose my SAG health insurance. And so that does make me need it a little more and rely on it a little more. But it's, I don't have the same feeling about it that I used to have.
That may change now with this. It's interesting to see what's going to happen on that with the whole virus thing.
Yeah, I mean, everything's unstable now. So even if I'd gone for a secure and steady line of work, everybody's kind of in the same boat right now.
For a comedy podcast, this is going in the wrong direction, don't you think?
I mean, it's comedy adjacent, I think. I don't know whether this is a comedy podcast, if it ever was. Here's a fun question. Do you have a favorite Tom Hanks performance?
Well, Forrest Gump, of course, and Saving Private Ryan. I think he was very good in that.
So you like 90s Hanks. That's the sweet spot for you.
Yeah.
Did it change your feeling towards him at all? I know Mom got very, Mom took it very personally.
Oh, God.
You claimed to me that you stopped watching Tom Hanks movies
I did.
I got fired, but then...
And then you busted me.
Then in conversation, you casually...
Well, I forgot.
You casually mentioned how much you liked The Post, and I said, that's a Tom Hanks movie. And you said, I thought you didn't go see them, because I've been going to see them.
And
this
what
whole
was
time.
My... And what I said?
You said, I went to see that for Meryl.
No, he's... I mean, let's face it, he's good in everything.
Well, you got to remember, Mom's Irish. She's born in Ireland. And the Irish forgive and forget, but never forget they forgave. And they hold grudges for hundreds of years. And they never forget. And so that didn't surprise me. No, I was disappointed, but I thought, well, I thought the whole Dead Eyes thing was kind of silly. But the more I thought about it over the years, I think it's because you were too tall.
For that character in that scene?
Character. When I saw the actual show itself, the guy is much shorter than the other characters, and he's, although there's no lines really, very few lines that he has, their looks are kind of comic looks. He's kind of a comic relief in a way. And if you were the same height or taller than the other actors, I don't think it'd have worked. Sorry to say that, but I think the guy they picked was a good choice for him.
I mean, I agree with you, Dad.
And as though you, I find you very funny, you wouldn't have been funny in that part.
That's a hard note you just gave me.
I know. I just thought of that. That's not good to say to you. I said I crushed your already fragile ego.
No, I think it's fair. I just was surprised by it. I didn't ask for that note, and you gave it anyway.
Well, I hope you get over it. I hope this doesn't scar you for life now that I zapped you like that.
I'll do a whole episode about what you just did to me. You're really happy with yourself.
Yeah, I am.
Really like that. It took me a few weeks before I realized something that it might sound like a bit of a stretch, but
The news broke that Tom Hanks had the coronavirus, and the next morning I was out of a job. A show business job. It's only the second time in my entire life that I have been let go from a job, and it is mind-boggling to me that there was once again a Tom Hanks connection, however indirect. I mean, I know this is not a similar situation at all, but still, that's weird, right? I mean, we saw those headlines that night, and 12 hours later, the tour was over. I apologize for making this all about me, although that is kind of baked into the cake at this point, right? One bit of good news in this whole situation is that there have been updates about Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson recovering. And it looks like they're going to be okay. And if you follow them on social media, the things they have both been posting are the kinds of things that are a comfort in a harrowing time. Including, I have to say, a genuinely solid typewriter joke by Tom Hanks on Instagram. So, I want to end by quoting something Tom Hanks said in one of his recent posts. He said, "It's going to take a while, but if we take care of each other, help where we can, and give up some comforts, this too shall pass." Which is what my mom always says. And Brian Miller said it too earlier in the episode. I guess it's kind of a cliche now, but maybe that just means everybody's saying it because it's true. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Ryan Miller, and all the musicians in Guster, whose music you heard bits and pieces of in this episode. Adam, Luke, Brian, Dave, Rebecca, and Bridget. Miss you guys. And also, of course, to my parents, Bill and Greta Ratliff. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast. Talk about us nicely on social media. I'd like to dedicate this episode to the memory of Adam Schlesinger, who, among his many accomplishments, was nominated for an Academy Award for writing the title song for the movie That Thing You Do. It's a song that makes you feel happy to be alive even when you're down in the dumps. Adam was someone I hoped I might get to talk to for this podcast someday. He was taken from us too soon. Stay safe, everybody. We'll be back with another episode before too long. Thanks for listening.
Was a HeadGum original.